Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Democratic National Committee this week revealed that Russian government hackers had infiltrated their network, gaining access to all email traffic and a database of opposition research on presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump. DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz told MSNBC that donor files were not compromised.
They did, as you said, get access to some opposition research files, but our primary concern was to make sure that we could secure the information of our state parties, reassure them and our supporters that we have a network that is now clean and that there was no personal information of our donors, no access to our voter file, and that our network is now secure.
U.S. officials have also revealed that campaign networks for Trump and presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton also were targeted. Today, we're talking about what these hacks bode for our national security and the rest of us. Joining us now by phone is national security reporter for The Washington Post, Ellen Nakashima. Welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you.
When did the DNC learn that something was wrong? When I went back into the files, it was sometime around March, maybe?
It was late April when... Yeah, the sort of information technology security team at the DNC noticed some suspicious activity on their networks and realized it was way out of the normal, and that they really should be calling in people with more expertise.
But it had been going on for quite a while, right?
It had been. So one of the two Russian spy groups that had gotten into the networks had been in for about a year at that point, just under a year maybe, without being detected.
Now, there's two Russian spy groups at work here, and they're not necessarily working together, right?
That's right. That's the analysis of CrowdStrike, a cybersecurity firm that the DNC hired to investigate the breach. And CrowdStrike has been studying Russian hacker groups for a number of years, and they determined that the breach was done by two different hacker groups, sort of almost in rivalry with one another. One working, they think, for the FSB, which is a successor agency to the KGB, and which Putin once headed, and the other working for a military intelligence agency, the GRU.
We are talking about the announcement by the Democratic National Committee that their computer network has been hacked. My guest is Ellen Nakashima. She's a national security reporter for The Washington Post. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, I want to clarify, these are absolutely government-funded hacker groups. They're not independents that are, you know, sharing their stuff on a freelance basis.
Right. Yes, that's the CrowdStrike said they're highly confident that these are Russian government hacker groups, not, you know, mercenaries, proxies, or people who are sort of just doing it on spec for the government, let's say.
How do experts know that the files about Donald Trump were targeted by the hackers? What indications are there? Do you know?
Well, the second group, which CrowdStrike has dubbed Fancy Bear. The first one they've called Cozy Bear. So it was Fancy Bear that got in sometime, to the best of their knowledge, in late April, which is how I think the DNC staff noticed the intrusion, noticed something was wrong. And that at that point, they were interested in the opposition research file on Donald Trump. They were not, they didn't go into any of the other parts of the network. Cozy Bear, the other group, for instance, was focused on emails and chat traffic. They were sitting on the email servers and monitoring everything going back and forth, whereas Fancy Bear focused on the opposition research file. CrowdStrike says, you know, they analyze this or see this through traces of malware or malicious software left behind, the way tactics and techniques and little signatures that are unique to various hacker groups in different countries. And they saw the telltale signs of Fancy Bear on the files of Donald Trump, the opposition research. Now, they actually saw signs of exfiltration or stealing or copying of two files for Trump.
Do we know anything about those files?
No. The DNC didn't release details.
Why would the DNC release news about this at all?
Well, I think their thinking was that, one thing, over the weekend, they conducted a massive cleanup operation. They disconnected, with CrowdStrike's help, they disconnected the networks, they cleaned everything out, they upgraded computers, they replaced some computers and servers, they had to put information back onto the clean computers. It was a huge job, and they thought that as a result of that, because there might have been some disruption, to email service and whatnot, it would get noticed, and it would eventually leak or come out. And they felt it would be preferable to, put the story out themselves and just explain what happened, rather than to have to come back later and try to, counter maybe a slightly inaccurate story.
How big of a deal is CrowdStrike? Can you talk about the cybersecurity firm that was hired to clean this mess up?
Yeah, they're one of the premier cybersecurity firms, in the industry, in the business. They're highly respected. Their co-founder, Dmitry Alperovich, is a longtime cybersecurity expert and forensics person who's also a fellow at the Atlantic Council. Their chief, he's security officer, chief information security officer, is Sean Henry, who is the former sort of top cyber official at the FBI, long years of working in cyber, both on the criminal side and the national security side. Sean is just one of the most experienced people in this sector, having had experience both inside the government and now outside in industry.
I think I read it in your article, Ellen, that the FBI and maybe the CIA have gotten involved, for sure the FBI, in working with the campaigns, working with the to help them secure their networks. What is the interest of the FBI in helping the campaign secure their networks?
Well, of course, so this is an interesting area. The FBI is both an investigative agency, and it also, it has to work with industry and organizations, because that's where the criminals and the foreign spy agencies are going. That's who they're targeting. And so the FBI spends a lot of time trying to do outreach to inform companies, private sector companies, as well as the, academia, universities, think tanks, media organizations that might get targeted, about the threats. They try to share information, specific information about threats. However, in some cases, they're constrained by the fact that they learn about hacks or intrusions through classified means, and so they say they can't always share full information on the tactics and techniques being used because it was obtained through classified sources, which they don't want to reveal. So that means sometimes they might not even be able to say that it was Russia or China, that we believe got into your network. But when they're working with a company or a victim, they do try to help as much as possible, and they say they really like it. They prefer when, companies also come to them if they notice something is wrong or suspicious. So, there are differing degrees of, let's say, cooperation between the private sector and the government in cyber.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I sensed sort of this, what's the word I'm searching for? Nonplussed, not particularly frantic reaction to all of this. It doesn't seem to be blowing anybody's mind. It goes on all the time, right?
Right. Well, so this is this breach is, in fact, it's a very high-profile one, but it's an example of classic political espionage. It's not sort of the commercial theft of intellectual property or data that we have seen a lot of in recent years, in which the United States government has pointed the finger at China on, you know, called them out specifically for the massive amount of economic espionage they're doing. So, you know, this is not the theft of, let's say, paint formula or something that's highly proprietary to a company that, if stolen, can then benefit another country's industry. Mm-hmm. And in that case, because it's considered more traditional political espionage and something that the United States does,
right,
for instance, right, it's not something the U.S. government is going to, you know, get on the phone to Putin about and you know, complain.
Well, right, but I think back to a couple years to the NSA breach and what, you know, when they found out that their calls were being, tapped or whatever that was.
Right, and with Merkel.
Yeah, Angela Merkel was, you know, flipping out, and people were all over the place outraged,
right,
by this.
They were, but, you know, if you talked to these, you know, the intelligence agencies and their top officials, they'd say, well, you know what? Who do you think the Germans are spying on or listening to, and whose phones are they tapping?
Yeah, right, right. Last month, hackers from foreign governments have targeted presidential campaigns in the past.
Right.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, in 2008, it became public that China had hacked the campaigns of then-candidate Obama and the Republican candidate nominee John McCain. And then again in 2012, the Chinese also compromised Obama's and, I believe, Romney's campaign networks. So, you know, there's a fairly long tradition of this now.
And why? I mean, as far as tapping into the Trump files from the DNC,
yeah,
is it, you know, we know that Putin and Trump have a congenial relationship, or maybe it's to blackmail Trump. Why do they do that?
Yeah, you know, we don't know for sure why, mm-hmm, but and maybe part of it might be eventually to get information that could be useful in blackmailing Trump, but surely it does have to do with what all, you know, intelligence agencies want to do, which is get information on the intentions and policies and proclivities of their adversaries' leadership and potential leadership. You know, with Trump becoming possibly the next U.S. president, they surely want to know as much as they can about him. And he hasn't been, a politician for very long, unlike Hillary Clinton. So, you know, the Russians are sort of, in a sense, playing catch-up a little with Trump.
Well, Ellen Nakashima, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Ellen Nakashima is a national security reporter for The Washington Post. She recently wrote about the infiltration by Russian hackers into the Democratic National Committee's computer network. We'll put a link to her story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue our conversation about this issue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Cybersecurity returns to the front burner this week after the Democratic National Committee revealed its computer network had been hacked by Russian government operators. Joining us now in the studio is Ohio State University law professor Dakota Rudisill. His research focuses on national security policy and cyber law, and he previously served in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
And also with us by phone is the Assistant Director of the Center for Cybersecurity at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, Richard Forno. His work in cybersecurity spans government, military, and the private sector, including helping build a formal cybersecurity program for the U.S. House of Representatives. Welcome back as well, Rick.
Good morning.
Dakota, how would you classify this DNC case? Was a crime committed? Is there any international law that addresses this? Is anyone going to go to the Russians and say, hey, you know, stop it?
Well, it's really the threshold question. When there's a disruption to a computer network of some kind, you really need to ask yourself, what's going on here, right? And your first thought should frankly be, this is just a glitch of some kind, right? I mean, it's just you've got a problem with the software. But once you kind of go beyond that point and you think that there's some sort of meddling or interference going on here, you've got a number of different baskets into which that you could put this. One is this is a crime. So under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, any unauthorized access or tampering with a computer or computer network is a federal crime. Another basket is that this is espionage. This is an intelligence service of some sort, trying to acquire information or carrying out some sort of clandestine activity. Another basket is this is an act of war, right? This is an armed attack, but not with bombs, but with basically a logic bomb, a computer worm or virus of some kind or tampering. And then maybe a last basket that you could put this tampering or hacking into is terrorism. This is an act of terrorism. Now, my sense based on everything that we've seen so far about this DNC hack is this is very, very classic espionage by the Russian security agencies just in the information age.
In other words, they didn't do any damage.
Based on everything that Ellen was talking about and that we know, it doesn't sound like they actually damaged the DNC systems. And instead, what they did is they gained unauthorized access to it and they downloaded information.
What do you think, Rick Forno? You agree it's a classic espionage and leave it at that and move forward to prevent the next attack?
Yes, I agree with Dakota completely. This looks very much like a classic case of online espionage by a nation state entity, in this case, Russia. The tools, the technologies, as we are aware of them today, strongly suggest this to be an espionage incident. So, yes, I agree completely.
But they did take things. So if someone broke into the target, the target network and stole identification of target customers, that would be a crime, right? But when they're taking information about, say, Donald Trump, that's not a crime, Rick Forno?
Well, they're both crimes. Okay. They're just prosecuted under different statutes. Unauthorized access to a computer system, and Dakota, you're a lawyer, so correct me if I'm wrong, but unauthorized access to a computer system, regardless of your purpose, is a crime. But then how it's specifically prosecuted can be either as a crime or espionage.
And is there prosecution of espionage as do we think of it, Dakota?
Both of those statutes are available. The Espionage Act is an older act, but it is available. And basically what the Espionage Act concerns itself with is gaining access to information with some element of intent, either to harm the interests of the United States or to aid a foreign power of some kind. And so both of those criminal authorities, the Espionage Act and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, would be available to federal prosecutors. Now, prosecution in U.S. courts, right? We're talking about people who are presumably sitting in Russia working for the Russian security services. Not the easiest thing in the world to say that we're going to prosecute them, right?
Spitting in the wind, maybe?
Well, it's fascinating because on the one hand, charges are filed with some regularity against intelligence agencies of various countries by other countries. And it's profoundly rare that anybody actually ends up standing in the dock and getting prosecuted for something, especially if they're not actually on the soil of the country that's complaining. What is interesting is that a few years ago, the Department of Justice got an indictment against five Chinese military officers where the United States government had reason to believe that they were substantially involved in hacking activities. The United States got this indictment, and it's believed that this is one of a number of factors which contributed to the United States and the Chinese government sitting down last year and talking about some rules of the road for cyber and for hacking. And they didn't move the ball a lot, but they made some progress. And there are some who think that the Chinese have actually changed their behavior a little bit since last year. And I'm not saying that that could happen with Russia, but it's interesting.
When I was reading about this, Rick Forno, and you know, Dakota Rudisill chime in, there was a lot of admiration extended to the Russians for their prowess as hackers. They're very well known as great hackers. Of course, they devote all their time to it, these particular groups.
Yes, and you know the techniques that were discovered and analyzed in this incident certainly are sophisticated. They're clever. They're certainly not unique in using these techniques, but to see them be successfully deployed and you know used for you know to get this information certainly is admirable in terms of technical sophistication and expertise. But I wouldn't say that they're the only people in the world that that can do this sort of stuff.
In other words, we know about it because our people can do it, right, Dakota?
Yeah.
Yeah, Rick? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the type of thing that, frankly, one would, I think, expect their intelligence services to carry out. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that there should be no response or that there can't be a response of some sort. Again, this is crime. Also, there are diplomatic channels. The United States can raise this with Russia, and it then becomes part of the broader context of relations between the United States and Russia, which, as anybody's been reading the news in the past 2 years know, U.S.-Russian relations have reached their coldest and lowest point over the past 2 years since the depths of the Cold War.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the issue of cybersecurity in 2016. It changes almost constantly. It seems like there's always something. The Democratic National Committee reported recently that Russian hackers, Russian government-backed hackers, had two different groups had infiltrated the computer network of the DNC. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org. Here with me in the studio is Dakota Rudisill. He is an assistant professor of law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Also, Dr. Richard Forno, assistant director of the Graduate Cybersecurity Program at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County Center for Cybersecurity. The last time we had you both on the show, President Obama had just announced the formation of the Cyber Threat Intelligence Integration Center, and health insurance company Anthem had just revealed that data from 80 million customers was stolen by hackers. That was over a year ago. Are we getting any better at cybersecurity in this country? Are things like this episode with the Russians edifying, or is it the same old thing and we just nailed them one more time? Dakota Rudisill?
Well, it's very much an iterative process with cybersecurity, and that owes to, number one, just the complexity of the problem, right? I mean, there are billions and billions of computers and computer networks and people who are writing code and trying to break code. You just think about all the new software products, right, which are launched in a single year, all the different users, all the different people who want to penetrate them. And so what you end up with is not only a kind of tech context, which is enormously complex, but also a regulatory one, which is enormously complex as well for the federal government, state governments, local governments, international players. And so it's I would think of cybersecurity as, you know, you're looking at, to borrow another metaphor, you know, a dam that has, you know, 1,000 little leaks, and now and then a bigger leak opens up and you're somehow running around trying to figure out how you can plug all of these and maybe even try to prevent some. So it's just an enormously challenging task.
Rick Forno, what do you think? I mean, is this a constant? It's a process. It's never going to end.
It's an ongoing process. I like Dakota's dam analogy. Mm-hmm. I tend to think of it also as whack-a-mole, where mm-hmm. you attack one problem and then three more pop up the next day or the next hour. It is an ongoing iterative process, but it's job security for many of us in the industry, obviously. But one of the complex issues we have to address, and I don't think there's an easy answer, is that all it takes is one person to do something wrong to place the entire organization at risk. Let's go back to the DNC hack for a moment. Mm-hmm. Let's say one employee plugged in a thumb drive or opened an email from an unknown source, and they got infected by malware, malicious software. That one action, that one mouse click, places the entire organization at risk. And how do we educate and condition people to, you know, practice safe computing? It's very difficult. It's sort of like saying, well, you should obey the speed limit when on the road. How many people actually do that? They drive safely. They may speed, but they're safe. We may know the rules of the road for computing and how to use computers, but every now and then we push the limits a little bit and we see problems. So a lot of it is human-based, not just technology-based.
Right, which is something we often don't think of it in terms of that. We think it's just some sort of language on the computer and they're getting in, but they have to have a way to get in. It's not, and they're looking for a weak link.
And that's usually the human being, the end user behind the keyboard that gets tricked into doing something or does something unintentionally.
So CrowdStrike, the security firm CrowdStrike, was called in by the DNC to address this issue. And what do they do after? It's first they identify it and they figure out who it was and what it was. But then, Rick Forno, what do they do to prevent it from happening again? Or is it just a matter of rebuilding the firewalls or whatever you do and then waiting for the next person to, click on the wrong link?
Well, there are a couple of technical ways to go about doing this. Presumably, the CrowdStrike team went into the DNC. They brought some tools and sensors to collect information and begin to piece together the various clues, artifacts that the intruders left to figure out, firstly, what happened technically, and then how to first stop this from occurring, and then from there work backwards to remove the bad software from the various systems. Once that's done, the CrowdStrike folks and the DNC will continue to monitor the network to look for additional signs of activity. Maybe they missed something, or there's another adversary there that they didn't know about. So it's, identify the problem, triage it, fix the immediate threat, which they did, and then continue to monitor in case you miss something or in case the adversary tries to come back.
How can you tell what's been taken versus what's just been observed?
That's a very difficult question to answer, because unless you're tracking every single file on your network or on your servers or every email, it's hard to know. If the hackers, the adversaries, are known to be on a certain server and that server contains campaign information or opposition research, you have to suspect that everything on that server has been taken. Even if it wasn't, that's your initial assumption, because you don't know.
If they had taken, Dakota Rudisill, data about donors, personal information about donors, would that have been a different sort of a crime than just getting the background or the opposition research on Donald Trump?
So potentially it could, and we're starting to wander a little far from my national security expertise here. I mean, there may be financial transaction law which might be relevant, uh-huh. if the Russians had gone after the donor records. But what I think is interesting here is that, Donald Trump, one of his selling points for himself is that he's the big billionaire, and so he doesn't need, he doesn't need to do campaign fundraising, so therefore he's not going to be in the back pocket of any donors.
He is collecting money, though, from people.
He is. He absolutely is. But what's interesting is that the Russians might, frankly, be buying the Donald Trump line, right, which is that he's basically self-financing. And so maybe they're not that interested in his donors, but instead they're very keenly interested in what the DNC may have dug up in their opposition research about Trump, right? About his past business dealings, about his personal life. This is the sort of information that intelligence services love to get.
Just gossip mongers, and when it comes right down to it. Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hi there. So I'm thinking of an analogy, so follow me for a second here. When one cell in a human body is infected, the other cells kind of block it off. It doesn't kill you. It doesn't kill the whole system. So how are we actually have a computerized system that depends on one person not making any mistakes, and yet the whole system gets infected if one person accidentally clicks on the wrong link in an email. Isn't that just a really stupid system?
Yeah, I wondered about that too, but thanks for asking the question because I feel like all my questions on this are so stupid. But why can't there be, you know, some kind of filters?
Sure. There are ways that you can raise the bar to make it more difficult for one person to do significant damage. The trade-off is that may require, you know, additional levels of user activity, you know, redundant passwords or various ways of logging in. Makes it more difficult for the user to conduct their business. So there's that trade-off we often hear in the industry about, you know, having good enough security to keep the bad guys out, but not so much security that we can't do our job day to day. And there are these trade-offs in every organization. I agree it's a stupid system, and maybe I was being a bit too general in my remarks, but I certainly agree that, you know, one person can cause significant damage if they, you know, if they're targeted and successfully exploited.
Fred, go ahead. Thanks for that call. Dakota?
Yeah, so I would just add that this virus analogy is actually a really, really good one. You know, we've used it so long with now computers, we just kind of accept it. But when you really think about how viruses and bacteria operate, right, they're varying strengths, right? I mean, all of us every single day are exposed to viruses and to bacteria. And, you know, we have just every day little cuts and bruises, and we ingest things in what we drink and what we eat, right? And the vast majority of them don't really have any sort of impact on us because we've got antibodies. Our bodies can fight them effectively. And so you kind of you think about the regular antivirus software, right, that you run on your laptop or that your phone is running or something like that, deals with most of them, right? They never get in, or if they do, they're dealt with very, very quickly, right? But there are some which are especially communicable and powerful and sneaky. And it's those where, you know, it's the one click, it's the one flash drive, it's that entry, in the same way that, you know, one needle prick, you know, with a syringe which has HIV in it, you know, can obviously have enormous effect.
And I would expand on that, if I may, to say that, yes, that one virus, that one pinprick, that one virus cell, in this case, it's a very intelligent virus and a very intelligent cell, and it knows the other cells are trying to defend against it, and it does things to work around those countermeasures. So it's a very intelligent virus. It's not, you know, it's much more complicated than it was 10 or 20 years ago.
We're talking about hacking, and particularly when it comes to important computer networks like the Democratic National Committee. They reported recently that they discovered that Russian government-backed hackers had gained access to their systems. We know that they've taken information from the opposition research on Donald Trump, for example, and other information. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page as well. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Democratic National Committee this week revealed that its computer network had been infiltrated by Russian government hackers. We're talking about what that means for governments like the U.S. and the rest of us. Still with us in the studio is Ohio State University law professor Dakota Rudisill, whose research focuses on national security policy and cyber law, and he previously served in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Also with us by phone is the Assistant Director of the Center for Cybersecurity at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, Richard Forno. His work in cybersecurity spans government, military, and the private sector, including helping build a formal cybersecurity program for the U.S. House of Representatives. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, we were talking off the air, Dakota Rudisill, and you were talking about how, you know, taking that virus analogy a little bit farther is a way to explain why cyber attacks are different than dropping a real bomb on a real place.
That's right. They're importantly different. So the United States and actually NATO this week have now recognized the use of force in cyberspace as another context for the use of force, just like air and land and sea. But something that's fundamentally different about a cyber weapon versus what's called a kinetic weapon, like a missile or a bomb, is that your kinetic weapon, like a missile or a bomb, when it goes off, that's one event. You have boom and it's essentially done at that point. What's different about a cyber weapon is that it's often a very intelligent virus, and this can be launched against a target, have some damage, which is intended, but then it can persist and it can move and it can migrate and have all sorts of effects that you can try to predict. But often predicting the impact of viruses, especially beyond the intended target, is really, really tough.
And you said that happened a couple years ago in Iran.
That's right. According to the public record, the United States was involved with crafting a cyber weapon called Stuxnet, which was then launched via flash drive against the Iranian nuclear program. It had its intended effect of destroying centrifuges in Iran and setting back their nuclear program, but it also got out on the internet and started showing up worldwide in all sorts of civilian systems. And that's a practical problem, but it's also a legal problem, because the law of armed conflict, which applies to use of cyber weapons, says you have to respect a principle called proportionality. And what proportionality means is that your unintended damage to civilians and their property cannot outweigh the value of the military target which is attacked. And so if you're talking about a computer virus that may get out there and may spread and you don't have a sense of how far it can, it makes doing that proportionality analysis really, really hard.
And Stuxnet was an example of how that went out and did a lot more damage to a lot of other things and people than was intended.
That's right. My sense is, based on what I read, that it didn't do as much damage to other civilian systems as it actually did to the Iranian nuclear systems. But it did get out there. It did get onto other computers, and it did cause damage to them.
One of the biggest concerns in cybersecurity is the vulnerability of our infrastructure, things like the power grid. Just how vulnerable are those systems and how well prepared are we, Rick Forno? I know we had that blackout a few years ago, I think maybe 7 or 8 years ago, when a big part of the grid went out, and it was a computer glitch, I think, at that point. But it made everybody think about cybersecurity, too.
Yes. And the question of the power grid or the water treatment plant as critical infrastructures, that's been an open question since the mid-1990s, when this notion of critical networked infrastructure really became a worry here in Washington and around the world going into the dot-com days. It is and it remains a very real concern for everybody, the utility companies and governments alike. One of the big concerns and problems is that a lot of the systems that control power generators and water plants and sewage plants is that the computers, they're embedded. They're not like a laptop or a mobile device. They're, you know, firmware, stuff that's been made at the manufacturer that you can't easily update or fix. And the only way to update the software, if you will, is to put in a whole new device. Well, it's kind of hard to put in a whole new power generator just because there's a new vulnerability.
Well, that kind of sounds, you talk about stupid. That sounds really stupid in this day and age.
But we did not know this. I mean, the systems that are feeding us power now were installed 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Right, okay.
We didn't think about hackers and things like that back then.
Yeah, Dakota? Russo?
Yeah, so the power grid is one of the most worrisome aspects of this entire threat matrix when you think about cyber threats. And folks have been talking about this for a number of years, that you could have a cyber attack on the power grid. And it was essentially hypothetical until about the last year or so when we learned a couple things. Number one, there was, according to the public record, there were some probably Russian-written viruses found on some power systems within the northeastern United States. And second, in December, a day before, 2 days before Christmas, again, based on the public record, the hackers inside Russia carried out a cyber attack on the Ukrainian power system and shut large portions of it down in the middle of the winter in that part of the world, which is an extremely serious thing.
It's an attack.
It's happened. It's now happened. That threshold has been crossed and, you know, a power grid has been shut down. And what's interesting about that, again, to come back to the legal aspect of this, right, is, you know, it's primarily civilians that depend on power systems. And so this is an attack which its primary effects are directed towards non-combatants.
Which is an act of war.
I would build on.
Uh-huh, Rick.
I would expand on that and say it's also, if you look at all the network devices that are in the civilian world these days, medical drug machines in hospitals that dispense prescription drugs through IV tubes, the Internet of Things, I hate that word, but that's certainly a concern. All these network devices that are controlling more and more of our society, from cars to toasters to air conditioners, all of these have vulnerabilities in them, and they all can have direct consequences for the people who depend on them.
And if you write the right virus, they could infect a whole bunch at the same time.
Correct.
So when the day comes when we're all depending on a computer to unlock our front door, that
make sure you have a key.
Yeah, just make sure you have a spare key, right? We have a note from Edie on Facebook, or a question from Edie on Facebook that I don't know if you guys can answer this or not, but Edie writes, so is the RNC, the Republican National Committee, more secure, or have we just not yet heard about the Russians snooping there too? I think that's a good question. I think the FBI, when they got together with the DNC, also got together with the RNC. I'm not sure, but what about that? I mean, is it possible they just haven't found them yet, Dakota?
So I would say that one of the big differences here is that, you know, Donald Trump is relatively new to the American political scene, right? In contrast, Hillary Rodham Clinton has been in the public eye for a quarter century, and there have been numerous investigations and so many things that Hillary Rodham Clinton has been involved with over the past 25 years, from, you know, Whitewater to someone to Benghazi to. So in that respect, right, American investigators are doing the work and putting the work out, you know, putting
it's already mostly out there.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, there's, I would be shocked if there was any, you know, any significant, you know, dirt that, you know, could be found about Hillary Rodham Clinton that is not in the public record. And, you know, I would say that I think that the depictions of her are just, you know, are kind of ridiculous in our political system. But I would just say there's a lot of information about her out there in the American political system for anyone to find. In contrast, about Trump,
yeah,
he's a relatively new actor. And so I think that's why the Russian security services would be more apt to go after the DNC, because it's doing that opposition research, than it would to go after the Republicans.
So you're saying maybe another year, another candidate, they might go for the RNC, but
look,
the DNC is the hot property this year.
Yeah, I mean, the Russian security services are very sophisticated and aggressive. They want to know everything they can. So when they sit down with the president and the other decision makers in Russia, they can give them the most tantalizing and interesting pieces of clandestinely obtained information they can.
So going back to this infrastructure thing, which, you know, I was without power for several days when that glitch occurred. Richard Forno, how well does the government work with these agencies, with these utilities to protect them, particularly in light of what Dakota Rudisill just said about the Russians attacking the computer systems regarding the utilities in Ukraine?
Oh, I think there's there is and has been extremely close cooperation between federal, state, and local government officials and the various utility operators for the power grid or the water plants or what have you. They know this is a concern. They've known about this for years, and in many ways, they've got a very symbiotic relationship. There's good information sharing, intelligence sharing between the government and these private sector entities. The private sector entities will report things they're seeing to a government group as well. So they're cooperating very well. But the key thing is, you know, the lines of communication need to stay open. They've got to be able to collaborate and cooperate in almost real time. And, you know, when a big enough problem manifests itself, there's got to be the resources there to deal with it, whether it's people or money.
Mm-hmm. Dakota?
Yeah, I would just add to that I think it's very interesting that the DNC turned to a private sector actor, right, CrowdStrike, right, to help them with this intrusion by a state actor, right? And I think that what that points up is that that the government is an imperfect solution when we're talking about cyber insecurity. Right. And part of that, frankly, stems because of our constitutional values and our valuing of privacy and our laws which protect privacy and protect our communications. Right. We don't have the United States government having access to, you know, every piece of electronic information in this country. And we don't have, you know, the United States government on every electronic device in the country protecting it because if they were doing that, right, they would also be gathering information on it. And so in that context, you know, we just cannot place full reliance on the public sector.
You know, Rick Forno, going back to what you said about how the computers that operate the equipment when it comes to the power grid, when it comes to how our water is treated, all of these things, you said the problem is that the computers are embedded. You can't just update them. You can't change them. Is there any kind of effort to change that, you know, as we go forward and we do upgrade our systems from time to time when someone lets money loose? Is that something that should become a standard, or are they talking about that?
Oh, sure. I mean, as systems break, newer systems that are upgradable over time are used as replacements. So as, you know, the natural order of attrition occurs, the newer models of whatever are certainly able to be fixed on the fly as need be. There are researchers and companies that look to apply fixes to older technologies as sort of a halfway point. You know, the machine might still work, but let's see if we can extend its life by another 10 years by fixing these 5 security problems. So I think really it's just that's a long-term strategic problem that it just takes time to overcome.
And does embedment of those computers have their benefits? And likewise, I guess the other side of the coin, does emancipating those computers have drawbacks?
Exactly. The embedded systems, on one hand, they're very difficult to tamper with. From the outside, you have to actually be connected to it in person, usually. So that's a plus from a security perspective. The flip side is it's more difficult to upgrade or fix problems when they're discovered because of the way the system is designed. So there are trade-offs, absolutely.
And just in parting with both of you, I wanted to ask, you know, you sort of joked a little bit, Rick Forno, but you're serious, too. This is a full employment situation for people like you.
There it is. There is a huge need for qualified, competent cybersecurity practitioners at all levels, technicians and non-technicians alike, throughout the country and around the world. So, yes, it's a booming field, and the need I don't see is going away anytime soon.
And Dakota Rudisill, you're nodding your head the whole time.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I tell my law students, you know, there are all sorts of fascinating things that you can do in the law. If you want to go into an area of the law which you can be certain is going to be growing in terms of demand, you know, over the next half century, I tell them there's basically three. Number one is the energy and environment basket of issues. Second is the aging of the baby boom generation and everything that goes with people getting old and, you know, their property and their health. And the third is computers, and especially cybersecurity, because we're going to get just so much more cyber dependent. And the advantages of that are going to go up, and the disadvantages and risks.
Well, I want to thank you both, Dakota Rudisill, Assistant Professor of Law at Ohio State University, Moritz College of Law. Thanks for joining us again. I appreciate it. And Dr. Richard Forno, Assistant Director of the Graduate Cybersecurity Program at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County Center for Cybersecurity. Thanks for joining us again. Appreciate your time.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thanks to the AllSide staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, AllSide's interns Summer Cartwright, Vaughn Hunt, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.